Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 539, titled Beneath the Covers. This is being recorded on January 29th of the year 2006. Well, once again, Happy New Year. Welcome back, those of you who are regular listeners. This is the first originally produced program of the new year. I've been involved with a writing project. Specifically, I not only wrote a general introduction to a number of great old anti-fascist books that are available on the Spitfire website for download for free on very compact Adobe PDF files, but I've also written individual descriptions and reviews of each book. And this has been done to basically help flesh out listeners' understanding of the history of fascism, and that in turn being done in order to help underpin their understanding of contemporary events and fascism. In particular, I think not only in terms of grasping the essence of when I talk about the Bormann Capital Network, understanding that, understanding how that could be perpetuated, and also understanding my discussion of the fifth column that is operating in this country, particularly in conjunction with September 11th, I think that understanding the history and methodology of fascism is essential. What I'm doing in this program is actually reading from some of the descriptions that I've written, not only the introduction to these books, but also some of the descriptions to the individual books by way of sort of presenting not only a transition to the new production, the newly produced programs, but also a transition from the past to the present. Now, one of the things that I talk about, obviously, and have talked about at great length over the recent years, concerns the Underground Reich and the Bormann Capital Network. In turn, it's important to understand that the Third Reich had planned to go underground for a long time. As soon as the Battle of Stalingrad was complete, the Nazis had plans to continue in a post-war fashion. The 1944 book, The Nazis Go Underground, by Kurt Rees, talks about that, and in my introduction I summarize that book. The Third Reich's elaborate plans for post-war underground survival and continuity were predicated on the certainty that the multinational corporate community would preserve the Nazi infrastructure as a bulwark against communism during the then-imminent Cold War. The Nazis Go Underground, published in early 1940, This Underground Reich was foreseen and analyzed in Kurt Rees's The Nazis Go Underground, published in early 1944. In addition to the powerful corporate economic interests allied with Nazi business centers, the process of underground perpetuation was greatly aided by fifth column movements abroad, those in Argentina and the United States in particular. Composed of ideological supporters of the fascist philosophy, these fifth column movements were instrumental in realizing Nazi blueprints for military conquest during the war, as well as post-war continuation and enlargement of those plans. Of particular significance in Rees's projection of post-war Nazi continuity is the Thiessen family of German industrialists. Headed by Fritz Thiessen, Hitler's first prominent financial backer in Germany, the Thiessen firm was a linchpin of German and Nazi heavy industrial production and was deeply connected to powerful corporate interests abroad. Paramount among the foreign corporate allies of the Thiessens were the Harriman interests, including George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather, respectively, of the current seated president. For the Record shows 273, 361, 370, and 435 highlight the genesis of the Thiessen-Harriman-Bush axis, as well as its successful post-war continuation as part of the Underground Reich. Kurt Rees believed that the Nazis would seek to exploit the large fifth column movement in the United States in order to expand their influence in America in the post-war period. In addition to powerful American industrial and political figures sympathetic to the Nazi persuasion, Rees foresaw an alliance between reactionary fundamentalist American Christians and Nazis as a likely development. It is interesting to reflect on his projection against the background of the growth of the Christian right in recent years. For more about this subject, see For the Record 497. In order to assure placement of important Nazis in post-war Germany in secure positions, Reese projects that the Third Reich would implant trusted operatives in municipal organizations essential to maintain infrastructure such as the police, fire departments, and public utilities. By placing SS and Gestapo veterans in positions deemed essential to maintain post-war society, the Nazis would be able to guarantee the survival of a viable political underground distributed throughout the country. In For the Record 421, we examine the curious circumstances of Arnold Schwarzenegger's father, Gustav. There's evidence to suggest that the elder Schwarzenegger, a small-town police chief in Austria, may have been one of these underground operatives. Supplemental information about Schwarzenegger Sr. is contained in For the Record 529. Well, I've noted not only that the denazification process in Germany was in many ways attenuated. Some of the more obvious and obnoxious Nazis were disposed of or imprisoned at least for a time. But basically, most of the vast bulk of the people in the Third Reich and the vast bulk of the power brokers, as well as those in fascist Japan, simply had to take off their uniforms. They got a little wrist slap. They were allowed to keep all of the money that they had stolen during World War II, and then put right back in position as business and political partners of the U.S. for the coming Cold War. By the way, something I'm not going to go into at great length right now, but in the book The Devil's Chemists by Josiah Du Bois, he goes into the tremendous gains that the Soviet Union and Red China gained or basically were able to achieve during the Cold War as a result of the resentment of the populations in Europe and Asia at the reinstitution of fascist industry, both in Japan and Germany. These were the people under whose yokes those residents of Asia and Europe had suffered, and that in turn did a lot to further communist propaganda and undermine the position of the United States. One of the things to note, as I talk about the underground Reich, one of the things to remember is that there was a powerful fifth column in the United States that was active on behalf of Nazi Germany and fascist Japan, and it was never disposed of. There was no denazification process for the United States. I'm going to read now some of the description for the book Undercover by John Roy Carlson. In Undercover, My 4 Years in the Nazi Underworld in America, John Roy Carlson penned the account of his successful infiltration of the vigorous Nazi Fifth Column that existed in the United States before and during World War II. Posing as a sympathizer and activist on behalf of the Nazi cause, Carlson gained access to the inner sanctum of the traitors, great and small, who sought to replace the Stars and Stripes with the swastika. In Undercover, the author chronicles the operations and ideological tenets of a large and frequently overlapping group of organizations that operated on behalf of the Third Reich and also Imperial Japan. As Carlson illustrates in the book, the small fry domestic fascists are often cat's paws for larger, more prominent political and economic figures. Many of the organizations were actually directed and financed by the Deutsches Auslandinstitut, the foreign section of the Nazi Party of Germany. And John Roy Carlson goes on to talk about the German-American Bund. This was an organization that was basically a direct extension of Third Reich intelligence operations abroad. It represented itself, however, as an organization that was dedicated to preserving the civil liberties of German Americans in a fashion not unlike the way many of the Muslim Brotherhood cat's paws organizations in the United States represent themselves as civil liberties organizations for Arabs and Muslims. In fact, the truth is a good deal different. Of the development of the German-American Bund, author Carlson writes here, skipping down in the description, author Carlson sets forth the Bund's early history. Note that founder Fritz Gisabel was an associate of Hitler, dating his connection to the 1923 beer hall putsch in Munich. Like many domestic fascists, Gisabel's Bund ally Hans Spunknebel was an employee of Henry Ford, one of Hitler's earliest financial backers. Ford supported many domestic fascists and their movements as well as backing Hitler. Carlson details Ford's association with white Russian exiles in the publishing of the anti-Semitic tract The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, as well as the financing of Hitler. For more about this subject, see, among other programs, For the Record 511. And then turning to the text from Carlson's book, The foundations of the Bund were laid in 1924. It originated with the Chicago unit of the Teutonia Club when that club raised a platoon of stormtroopers modeled directly on Hitler's brown shirts and adopted the swastika. The Teutonia Clubs were originally founded in Detroit by Fritz Gisabel, a German alien who was with Hitler in the Munich beer hall putsch. 8 years later, under Heinz Sponknobel, a former worker for Henry Ford, the Friends of the Hitler movement was founded in Detroit and in other cities. And then continuing, also on page 111, the author highlights the Americanization of the Bund, its transformation into a patriotic American organization in order to make it more marketable. Like many domestic fascist movements, the Bund represented itself as, quote, patriotic, unquote. As Dr. Johnson noted centuries ago, patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, unquote. Note that Bund leader Fritz Kuhn was also a Ford employee. When Hitler became chancellor on January 30th of 1933, Sponknobel was called to Germany. On his return to America, the Friends of the Hitler Movement changed its name to Friends of the New Germany, Freunde des Neuen Deutschlands, and continued to function under that name. In the meanwhile, Fritz Kuhn, also working as a chemist in Henry Ford's plant, became the Führer of the Detroit Regional Group. In December 1935, a merger of all the scattered Friends was effected, and Kuhn was appointed Supreme Bundesführer. In June of 1936, the Friends were Americanized to the German-American Bund, America Deutscher Volksbund, and launched on a national campaign of treason under the guise of star-spangled patriotism. One of the things that Carlson also notes, again, is that powerful people were involved with this fifth column, and as we'll see, one of the organizations that was bringing Nazi propaganda for dissemination by this fifth column was the Hamburg America Line. That was one of the businesses that linked the Bush family to Nazi Germany. It also, as we've seen in For the Record program number 273, was one of the businesses tabbed by the Nazis to help further their post-war German activities. On page 112, Carlson writes, "The Deutsches Ausland Institut launched a two-prong pincer attack on our democracy. Leadership on the first fifth column was entrusted to German Americans, while the second was entrusted to carefully selected candidates of non-German, 100% American ancestry, the Edmondsons and Pellies, whose job it was literally to translate Nazi propaganda into English terms and serve it as patriotism, unquote, for those who would swallow it as such. The American wing of the Nazi psychological fifth column penetrated Park Avenue society or business and industrial circles and eventually projected itself deep into the halls of Congress. One cannot stress too heavily that these subversives and traitors represented themselves as patriots," unquote. On page 113, Carlson notes the patriotic makeover that the Bund underwent. Note that much Third Reich propaganda and many spies came to the U.S. on the Hamburg America Line, one of the companies that featured the Bush family in partnership with the Third Reich. Quote, "It was the boom period for espionage in which the boats of the Hamburg America Line played a prominent role. Dr. Colin Ross, a Nazi of Scot ancestry, toured America photographing our industries, harbors, power and power plants, and rallying Hitlerites in our cities. Germans in America, too, have experienced their Versailles," he wrote. "A man will arise and rally them, a German, Tom Paine." Carlson then goes on to note, first of all, that these organizations represent themselves as Christians, and they also represent themselves as patriots. And in fact, they are not patriotic, and Jesus would have nothing to do with what these people are all about. And again, many prominent people were part of this underground. He notes, for example, the role of the Reverend Norman Vincent Peale in fronting for a notorious German and Japanese spy named Edward Rumley. Frank Gannett, whose name is carried by the newspaper chain that he founded, was also active with Peale and Rumley. The point here is that the United States was never denazified after World War II, and when we began bringing in the Crusade for Freedom Nazis, the Galen Spy Outfit, the Project Paperclip Boys, they were all operating as wings of an underground Reich under the political control of the Bormann Capital Network and the related Mueller Security Outfit. And basically these hooked up with the fifth column in the United States. One of the books, one of a number of books that talks about the frustration of the attempts at decartelizing Germany and breaking up this transatlantic financial axis is the book All Honorable Men. Reading now from the description to that book, American-linked German corporations were pivotal in financing the political ascension of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. In addition, the cartel agreements between corporate industrial giants on both sides of the Atlantic were instrumental in giving Germany access to vital strategic raw materials and technologies while restricting that access for the Allies. During World War II, the job of interdicting the transatlantic cartel relationships between German and American firms fell to the Economic Warfare Section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. Headed by James Stewart Martin, this group was titled the Bombing Boys because they helped to generate target selection for the strategic aerial bombardment of German industry. After the war, Martin served as the point man in the unsuccessful attempt at dissolving the transatlantic financial and industrial axis and decartelizing Germany. Martin's All Honorable Men from 1950 documents the manner in which powerful economic interests in the United States frustrated attempts at decartelization, thereby ensuring the post-war perpetuation of globalized business as usual, unquote, for both Germany and the United States. As Martin points out, these commercial interests were able to successfully manipulate the networks through which government operates and direct it to their own nefarious ends. In addition to lobbying in Congress and waging a vigorous public relations campaign against decartelization, the American partners of the German cartel successfully placed their own personnel in positions of responsibility for the post-war economic, quote, reconstruction, unquote, of Germany. And again, it is against the background of this perpetuation of the cartel agreements that the Bormann Organization and the Underground Reich must be viewed. And in analyzing the Underground Reich, remember that the Underground Reich is an economic entity. It is the greatest concentration of money power under a single control in history, in addition to the capital that they already had prior to World War II, and in addition to all of the capital that they garnered through the Marshall Plan and related programs after the war. By the end of 1943 alone, the Third Reich had looted an estimated $180 billion in early 40s dollars from Europe, not counting what they looted from the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. That is a fantastic sum of money, and it is that economic power and the political power that derives from it in the context of not only the international cartel system, but the failure to root out the Fifth Column movement in the United States and elsewhere, that the development of the Underground Reich must be viewed. The key work on the Bormann Group, done, of course, by Paul Manning, and in the description to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, I write, in late 2005, American popular culture paid homage to one of the greatest journalists of all time. In Good Night and Good Luck, the life and work of CBS radio and television journalist Edward R. Murrow provided the material for a Hollywood feature film. Paul Manning was arguably the greatest of Murrow's boys, the group of skilled journalists Murrow ran in Europe during World War II. After training as a gunner and flying combat missions in both Europe and over Japan, Murrow broadcast the surrenders of both Germany and Japan on the CBS radio network. After the war, Manning undertook an investigation of Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann, and the post-war capital network he ran. Partially underwritten by CBS, the story of the Bormann Organization proved too sensitive for the network to report. By the way, in his introduction to the book, Paul Manning mentions that Edward R. Murrow himself was very, very strongly supportive of Manning's investigation into the post-war Bormann network and felt that it should be published. Continuing with my description, that is, of the Paul Manning text. A decisively powerful network of corporate entities run by hardened SS veterans, the Bormann Group constitutes what one veteran banker termed the greatest concentration of money power under a single control in history, unquote. The foundation of the organization's clout is money, lots and lots of money. controlling German big business and through investments much of the rest of the world's economy, the organization was the repository for the stolen wealth of Europe, estimated by British intelligence to have totaled more than $180 billion by the end of 1943, not including the money taken from Greece and the former Soviet Union, nor that taken after 1943. Skipping down. In addition to the enormous power deriving from its consummate economic clout, the Bormann Group has wielded tremendous global influence through its intelligence and enforcement network. Administered by SS General Heinrich Müller, the wartime head of the Gestapo, the Bormann Group's intelligence and security network was composed of some of the toughest, most capable veterans of the SS. In addition, the Bormann organization and Mueller's security outfit have commanded the loyalty of the political, intelligence, and military elements requisitioned by the Allies after the war. In that regard, the Bormann-Mueller operation could draw on the loyalties of the Reinhard-Gehlen spy outfit that handled the CIA's intelligence on the former Soviet Union, and which ultimately became the intelligence service of the Federal Republic of Germany. In addition, Bormann and Mueller were the political masters of the numerous scientists recruited by the U.S. and other nations for their expertise during the Cold War, as well as the numerous Nazis brought into the U.S. under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. Those latter ultimately coalesced into a major element of the Republican Party. With its economic, political, and espionage capabilities, the Bormann Group embodies the triumph of the forces of National Socialism in the post-war period. Whereas the United States was the dominant element within the international cartel system prior to and during World War II, the Bormann Group is the primary entity in the post-war global corporate economy. The organization's clout has successfully obscured its existence in the face of journalistic investigation. Compare the official, unquote, fate of Bormann, supposedly killed at the end of the war, with demonstrable historical fact as researched by Manning. Relating information from the FBI's file on Bormann, Manning writes, quote, "The file revealed that he had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he, Bormann, held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th, 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National Citibank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all cleared through the Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires." And that about the Bormann Group. Taking a look now at a section from the book Germany Plots with the Kremlin, it may seem incredible for people unfamiliar with the recrudescence of the Third Reich underground after World War II, but it's important to remember that this was something they had been planning, and indeed one wants to see this event and this entity in the context in which it must be seen. One of the things that the Nazis did was to use a manifestation of their traditional Ostpolitik in order to convince American conservatives that they best go with the reinstitution of Nazi elements underground, because they threatened to the Nazis, that is, to hook up with the Soviet Union. And many conservatives who would otherwise have rejected a Nazi recrudescence went along with that program. And bearing in mind, too, the philosophy of Karl von Clausewitz that we looked at in Side 1, we're going to take a look now at a section of the description from Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens, and specifically we're going to take a look at a section from an article that was printed in the New York Herald Tribune on May 31st, 1940. This is an article by the late journalist Dorothy Thompson. From the description, "A stunning measure of the success of the Underground Reich and German Ostpolitik can be obtained by reading Dorothy Thompson's analysis of Germany's plans for world dominance by a centralized European economic union. In this, we can see the plans of pan-German theoretician Friedrich Liest as realized by the European Monetary Union." Ms. Thompson was writing in the New York Herald Tribune on May 31, 1940. Her comments are reproduced by Tettens on page 92. And again, from 1940, Dorothy Thompson writing, quote, "The Germans have a clear plan of what they intend to do in case of victory. I believe that I know the essentials of that plan. I've heard it from a sufficient number of important Germans to credit its authenticity. Germany's plan, now again, this is their plan for victory in World War II, as enunciated in 1940, beginning again, Germany's plan is to make a customs union of Europe with complete financial and economic control centered in Berlin. This will create at once the largest free trade area and the largest planned economy in the world. In Western Europe alone, there will be an economic unity of 400 million persons. To these will be added the resources of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. These will be pooled in the name of Europa Germanica, of Europa Germanica. The Germans count upon political power following economic power and not vice versa. Territorial changes do not concern them because there will be no France or England except as language groups. Little immediate concern is felt regarding political organizations. No nation will have the control of its financial or economic system or of its customs. The Nazification of all countries will be accomplished by economic pressure. In all countries, economic contacts have been established long ago with sympathetic businessmen and industrialists. As far as the United States is concerned, the planners of the World Germanica laugh off the idea of an armed invasion. They say that it will be completely unnecessary to take military action against the United States to force it to play ball with this system. Here, as in every country, they have established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations to whom they will offer advantages in cooperation with Germany. And again, compare that with the European Economic Union. It's basically what it is. It's a duty-free, enormous customs entity in central Germany. Going to conclude this program with James Stewart Martin's warning at the very end of the book, All Honorable Men. He writes, basically warning future generations that what happened in Germany could happen here. Again, the book written in 1950, quote, "The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of not more than 100 men if they could agree among themselves to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet. If the United States should run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity, then, may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of the financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And, more importantly, they could create a menace of their own here at home, not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. The men who would do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men." And that's how the book ends. And again, there's much, much food for thought about what we face now in the present and are going to be facing in the future. So please use the resources on the Spitfire website, including and especially these books and the introductions that I've worked so hard to write for you. This concludes For the Record program number 539, Beneath the Covers, being recorded, on January 29th of the year 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.